Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we are very honored to have in our studio now Pete Seeger. The folk music legend is 93. The occasion is the release of a new book called Pete Seeger in His Own Words. It's a collection of his letters, notes to himself, poetry, published articles, and more, edited by Sam Rosenthal, a writer and musician here in New York, and Rob Rosenthal, provost and sociology professor at Wesleyan University in Connecticut. Pete, it is so nice of you to add this to your day. Welcome back to WNYC.
Well, thank you. I've heard a great deal about your program. I'm afraid I haven't actually heard it because I don't normally listen to radio much or, for that matter, TV. I read when I have time, and that's how I actually...
Where do you get your news? Do you keep up on the news?
I leaf through the Sunday Times, and I leaf through a few little magazines like Orion. Did you ever hear of Orion?
No.
It probably has a few thousand readers and was started 10 years ago by a woman, several women, maybe 10 years ago. Now it has maybe 20,000 readers.
And it focuses on social issues, politics?
Yes.
That kind of thing. So let's go to some excerpts from your book. I'll read a few for our listeners since this is all your writings. And I want to focus for the couple that I picked out on the year 1956 because it was a long time ago and it seemed to have been a very eventful year for you and in our country's history. And I thought it would be interesting for folks to hear this. Somebody who was embroiled in national affairs in 1956 and world affairs.
Oh.
And of course, Woody Guthrie's been in the news for the 100th anniversary of his birth. And you have a letter to Woody in this collection written in the summer of 1956. And you wrote in part, "You may have heard I've been cited for contempt of Congress because I refused to answer questions before that committee last summer." That, of course, was the McCarthy Un-American Affairs Committee.
It was not McCarthy.
It was not.
Chairman Walters of the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Thank you.
McCarthy was a senator.
So you continue, "It may mean a costly court battle and even a year or so in jail, but it may not. Times are changing. And Toshi, your wife, and I aren't scared. Our neighbors up here in Dutchess Junction are just as swell to us as ever, and we feel confident that whatever happens, Danny and Mika, your kids, and Tinya also, won't be hurt. In fact,
Tinya was only just born.
Won't be hurt. In fact, I think they'll learn a lot." So first of all, talk about that. Well, you and Eric Holder have that in common, indicted for contempt of Congress. Did you ever have to go to jail? Did it come to that?
I think I spent 4 hours behind bars, and it was an interesting experience. I collected a folk song. While we were having lunch, the man I was in with two African-American men, and lunch was two slices of white bread with a piece of bologna between them, and one of them was singing, "If that judge believes what I say, I'll be leaving for home today." And the other man said, "Not if he sees your record, you won't."
Ha. You wrote that your kids would learn a lot from the whole thing in that passage that I read. Do you think they did?
I think so, yes. You learn of strengths and weaknesses in different kinds of people and in different kinds of words. Yes. I think we all learned.
Those hearings were, of course, about communism in the United States and what was seen as the communist threat. You had been a member of the CPUSA. You wrote a letter that same year as your Woody Guthrie letter, 1956, called "A Letter to My Grandchildren," in which you wrote, quote, They say that under communism, one has no political democracy and that people can be railroaded to jail for simply disagreeing with those in power. Communists in America always denied this. However, in this year of 1956, it now appears by admission of Russians themselves that all was and possibly is not as sweet as American communists hoped or believed. But when I think of communism, you continue, I not only think of this, I think of the communists I have known, bravery, steadfastness, and continual intellectual searching and thinking. Every communist leader I have known has lived life in the frank knowledge that it was unlikely that he or she would live their lives through without suffering jail sentences and possibly cruel death because of their beliefs. I never knew people so intent upon a long-range goal to make this a better world to live in, you wrote in 1956. How do you look back on your relationship with communism?
An education. Of course, you have to laugh at the different definitions of communism. Anthropologists say that all our ancestors were communists in the sense that we lived in tribes. And a tribe would sit around a council fire and make life and death decisions together. If there was food, everybody in the tribe had some of it. If a man shot a deer, maybe his wife got the best cut, but they didn't have any way to keep that deer. The rest of the tribe shared the rest of it. If there was hunger, everybody was hungry, including the chief and the chief's wife and children. And that's why it's called tribal communism. And all our ancestors lived in tribes.
But on a mass level in an industrial world, I guess it turned into something else. And I think in your words, you drifted away from it. So did you have a process of inspiration and then disillusionment?
Oh, yes. The big disillusionment from millions, billions of communists throughout the entire world was Khrushchev's rather informal speech shortly after that piece which you read. I think it was in 57. Every 5 years there'd be a formal meeting of the communists in the Soviet Union, and they would come there not to argue but to listen to what the new line was, what they were supposed to preach to the people. And Khrushchev said, you know, Comrade Stalin was a very strong leader, and he helped us win the war against Hitler, but he was also very cruel, and he sent people away to Siberia not without any chance to defend themselves. He just sent them off. Not thousands, not tens of thousands, not hundreds of thousands, but millions. Now there was a dead silence. No one had ever said such a thing in the Soviet Union. Finally, someone shouted, "Why didn't you speak up?" Now Khrushchev's entire demeanor changed. He said, "Who said that?" There was again a dead silence. And in a more normal tone of voice, Khrushchev said, "Now you see why I did not speak up." Hmm. Following that speech, my guess is 9 out of 10 members of the Communist Party in this country and in every country around the world resigned. Some would join another organization. There was one called, Democratic, in favor of democratic socialism, or something mm-hmm. like that.
It's a great story hearing about that moment, a piece of history not many Americans today know. And my guest is Pete Seeger on the occasion of the publication of the book. Pete Seeger, in his own words, it's a collection of his letters and articles and poetry and notes to himself and other things. I want to go back to that letter that you wrote to Woody Guthrie in the summer of 1956. At one point you wrote, "All the camps I've been to this summer where the kids holler out in that nice open way the kids do, not covering up or trying to make their voices sound pretty. This land is your land, this." In a way, we are all your children, Woody. What did you mean by, in a way, we're all your children, Woody?
We've learned about our country. We've learned about our history. Learned about ourselves from this extraordinary songwriter and artist, too. He drew pictures as well, and he told stories as well as making up songs. He kept a little notebook in his back pocket from childhood. There was a teacher in his primary school who found what a genius he was and suggested he read as much as he wanted and keep a notebook in his pocket and write down things. And then his parents moved to a different state. He moved from Oklahoma to the panhandle of Texas, 500 miles away, and a different teacher in a high school realized what an absolute genius this kid was, and again fed him books widely. I don't know how he was able to read so fast. When he came to New York City and I met him, we were visiting my sister-in-law, and on her shelf was a book of the French writer. I'm not sure if I pronounced the name right. Rabelais is what I've always called him. Maybe the S is not supposed to be pronounced.
Probably not.
Rabelais. And he had a habit of piling on the adjectives to one noun. 30 or 40. It was almost a joke. And Woody tried the same thing. He said, could he borrow the book? In 2 days, he returned it. And I noticed in the following weeks, he was experimenting with piling on adjectives for the fun of it.
So he was born in Oklahoma. You were born here in Manhattan. Do you feel that the two of you played different roles in the kind of activist folk song community?
I suppose so. I'm sure. I was 20 when I met him. He was 27, and I had a good ear. I was an ear musician, and I could accompany him on my banjo no matter what song he was singing. I could see a change in chords coming, and I didn't try anything too fancy. I just gave him a nice, solid backing. So he let me tag along with him, although he's supposed to have said, that Seeger guy is the youngest man I ever knew. He don't drink, he don't smoke, he don't chase girls.
Well, you talk about the music. I heard an interview with Woody's daughter last week in which she said he never cared about the music. He cared about his lyrics, his poetry. He never cared about his guitars or anything. But your grounding was in music first. So I'm curious how you saw the importance of the music as well as the words in your songs.
Well, Woody knew a good tune. He'd make up words first, but then he'd look around to a tune that people liked, and he'd borrow it. He'd use it. Woody is supposed to have once said about another songwriter, oh, he just stole from me, but I steal from everybody. Huh. I'm the biggest song stealer there ever was.
I read that your father was one of the founders of the field of ethnomusicology and that he lost his job as founder of the music department at UC Berkeley because of his pacifism during World War I. Is that true?
Well, my father was into classical music. As a teenager, he could listen to a symphony and he'd have in his hands what they call a score of the symphony. That's every single note played by every single one of those instruments. The violins, the piccolos, the clarinets, the bass, viol, and so on. And if one of them missed a note, he could hear it. So doing graduate work in Germany after he graduated from college, he hoped he would be a symphony conductor. But he found himself going deaf at an early age.
Like Beethoven.
And he decided, well, he would go into academia. He happened to meet the president of the University of California, and the president of the University admitted they did not have a music department, except one man teaching a course called Music Appreciation. And so he appointed my father at age 24 to be head of the music department. However, he met a lot of wonderful other professors there. One of them was Alfred Kruber, the anthropologist, who was the man who discovered Ishi, the Indian man of two worlds. Kruber's widow, Helen Kruber, wrote the story, Ishi, I-S-H-I. He was an Indian who had no contact with the white world until he was in middle age, I guess in his 40s.
So that's some of your father's relationship with music, but he was also political he lost his job because of his pacifism during World War I?
Well, these other professors said, Seeger, you may know about music, but you're an ignoramus when it comes to history and economics and so on. And pretty soon he was a socialist. These were the days of Eugene Debs, who got 200 votes, I think, in 1900, and then 400,000 votes for president 4 years later, and 800 votes. He doubled every 4 years. He said, in a few years, I'll be president. But along came World One and split the Socialist Party. And my father sided with the lefties, and he made speeches against imperialist war when Woodrow Wilson took us in, and he was given a sabbatical and told not to come back.
You served during World War II. Were you against the U.S. involvement in that war at first?
At first. Back when Hitler was going, the main strategy of both England and America was get Hitler and Stalin fighting. Truman put it in words when he was a senator. He said, we should help the one who's losing. So they would both get so weak, neither of them would give us any trouble. And on paper, it looked like a very smart political strategy. Then Stalin, in effect, said, you're going to sic him on me, I'll sic him on you. And he signs a non-aggression pact with Stalin. Nobody had ever anticipated that such a thing would happen. And all of a sudden, communists around the world now said, don't have anything to do with the World War. Let Hitler and Churchill fight it out. Roosevelt said, we are neutral, but we don't have to be neutral in our sympathy. And Roosevelt went in for what they call lend-lease and sent things. And finally, United States was in the war.
And didn't you even have a song back then about dancing around Hitler's grave or something like that?
Well, in 1950, my brain is slightly gone, as you notice. I'm 93 years old.
I haven't noticed the brain gone part, but no, go ahead.
I'm trying to think of the exact date. It was in 1952, was it?
After the war?
No, it was 40,
during the war?
No, it was
42.
42. 42. Hitler ignores the non-aggression pact with Stalin because his head of the Navy told him, we cannot invade England. We don't have enough oil. And where would he get oil? From the southern part of the Ukraine, down around the Caspian Sea, they have huge oil fields. So he declared war against Russia and was sure that within a few months he would take Moscow and take Stalingrad. To his great surprise, he did not take Moscow. The Soviets fought heroically, and he did not take Moscow, and his marshal did not take Stalingrad either.
And your song?
We had round and round, Hitler's grave, round and round we go. Gonna let that poor boy down, he won't get up no more. And Norman Corwin had a program called This Is War, and he had me and some friends – sing it. Of course, the following day, a newspaper man named Frederick Waltman had in the World Telegram, which was a major New York newspaper then, said, "Commie folk singers try to infiltrate radio." And that was the last job we got.
That's it, huh? Instead of rally round with the United States to help defeat Hitler in the war effort. We have a few minutes left with Pete Seeger on the occasion of the publication of the book. Pete Seeger, in his own words, he tells that story in one of the things that he writes in this book. That's a collection of his letters and published articles and notes to himself.
Well, I didn't know that Professor Rosenthal was going to write a book. I thought he was just going to write an article somewhere and quote one or two of my letters. But instead, he got his talented son, Sam, to work with him, and they put out a huge book, 334 pages.
Indeed. It's wonderful. And they didn't write it. You wrote it. Rob Rosenthal from Wesleyan edited it. Sam Rosenthal, writer and musician, also edited it. And there's a foreword by the composer and conductor David Amram. Let me get one question to you about some of your local activism. I'll take this from Jeff, writing on our website, who says, "Thank you, Pete Seeger, for your gift of music with meaning and soul and protest in the mid-1970s. When I was a young boy," he writes, "and attended the Clearwater festivals that you had in Cold Spring on the Hudson to raise awareness for pollution and helping to clean up that dirty old man river." Do you consider that perhaps your most successful activist venture, the quest to get the Hudson cleaned up?
Well, it's not really completely clean yet. You can swim in it. We have an annual swim across the river from the town of Newburg to the town of Beacon, where I live. René Dubos, the great French biologist, said, "Think globally, act locally." And that's really as close to my religion as I think I could possibly get.
What else do you consider on your greatest accomplishments list? Don't be modest.
No, I don't know. Some songs have been surprisingly successful where when I wrote them, I thought this is one more lesser effort. But a song that's called "Quite Early Morning," I've found I get audiences singing with me now, and maybe one of the more important songs that I ever wrote. On the other hand, the song "Turn, Turn, Turn," where I got the words out of the Bible, is one that is sung perhaps more than any other.
100 years from now, when people are studying music history or political history, and they don't spend a lot of time on Pete Seeger, what would be the most important thing for them to say?
I don't know. First of all, you're being optimistic. You're hoping there's going to be a human race here in 100 years.
I'm that optimistic.
If someone reads history, they'll come across my name. So, he made up songs that tried to persuade people to do something, not just say something.
The new book that's a collection of Pete Seeger's writings is called Pete Seeger in His Own Words, selected and edited by Rob Rosenthal and Sam Rosenthal. Such great honor to have you in the studio. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. It's been an honor to be on your program, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.
Turn, 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 and a time to every purpose under heaven.